From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Oregon Governor Kate Brown says she'll increase police presence in Portland, Oregon, after a fatal shooting over the weekend. A man was shot and killed Saturday night amid clashes between Trump supporters and counter-protesters, just days after another fatal shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin. For more in Portland, we have Dirk Vanderhart, politics and government reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Tanya.
Give us context for this week's shooting. There have been nightly protests for racial justice in Portland for the last 3 months, as we know, but the past few weeks have been different.
Yeah, that's right. Since May, the protests we've seen have often resulted in clashes between demonstrators and law enforcement. That was especially true in July when the president sent federal officers to the city. In the last couple weeks, the dynamic has shifted. What we've seen each of the last two weekends is conservative groups coming into Portland to demonstrate. And that has led to violence when they run up against these racial justice protesters. There has been open brawling in the streets. In some cases, different groups are shooting paintballs at each other or even spraying bear mace.
Walk us through what happened on Saturday with this shooting where a man was killed.
So there is not much concrete or official from law enforcement at this point. The investigation is playing out. What we do know is that the shooting occurred on Saturday just before 9 p.m. outside of a parking garage downtown here. That was shortly after the large pro-Trump rally I mentioned drove vehicles through the city, as I said, spurring clashes and violence. Officials have not confirmed the name of the victim in the shooting, but what we do know is he appears to be associated with a group called Patriot Prayer, which is a right-wing group in the Portland area that has frequently stirred up confrontations in the city.
Have police said anything about a suspect yet?
No, we are still waiting for anything concrete there, too. There is obviously a lot of speculation out there, but as I said, nothing official.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown stepped in last night and she laid out her plan to respond to this. What is she saying?
Brown is essentially saying that Portland police just don't have the resources right now to effectively handle the demonstrations. So her approach is to send in officers from both the state police and neighboring counties and cities to help relieve Portland officers. I think very notably, Brown is talking also about stepped up resources from federal agencies like the FBI, which is something many people on the ground will likely find alarming. But the basic point the governor is making is that violence and property destruction that Portland has seen this year is not going to be tolerated. People will be prosecuted and arrested, even as, she says, police will protect free speech and peaceful demonstrations.
You know, this has become a national issue. President Trump has been tweeting, calling Portland crime infested, saying local leaders have lost control. Mayor Ted Wheeler, on the other hand, blamed Trump for the violence. Let's listen.
Do you seriously wonder, Mr. President, why this is the first time in decades that America has seen this level of violence? It's you who have created the hate and the division.
Dirk, how much does the situation on the ground reflect what we're hearing from politicians at both the local and the national level?
Yeah, I think what your listeners should know, I mean, people should realize when they hear and see these things about Portland is that when violence occurs, it typically is contained to very small pockets of the city. This is not a city on fire or a city where you're going to be mobbed going about your business day to day. I mean, in the vast majority of Portland, life has continued on as usual. I think that with that said, I mean, when people like Wheeler talk about hate and division, it is certainly true that the groups that are clashing on Portland streets pretty clearly represent the stark polarization of the moment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in many ways a microcosm of what's happening in the country. What have you been seeing in Portland that can give us insight into what's happening across the rest of the country?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I guess what struck me is what this says about just how difficult and painful the changes we're talking about in the moment are. Portland officials believe they have taken meaningful steps to try to address concerns about policing. You know, they've stripped the police bureau of funding in some cases and taken away a controversial gun crimes unit. But protesters very, very clearly do not agree and have vowed to continue demonstrating until demands are met. And then at the same time, we have these other groups coming into the city to advocate the other way and in favor of the police, which is, of course, very in line with President Trump's rhetoric. There is just not a clear path out of those standoffs at that standoff at this point. And that is what I think is very concerning to people on the ground.
That's Dirk Vanderhart, reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Dirk, thank you so much for this insight.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, let's get an update now on COVID-19. Cases in the U.S. have passed 6 million. The number of Americans killed has passed 183,000. And the number of cases among college students is rising after just days back on campus. But there's also a growing assault on the truth. President Trump retweeted a conservative website that's falsely claiming a much lower death rate than 183,000. They're saying just 9,000. Dr. Lena Wen is an emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University. Dr. Wen, start with what you're seeing as you assess data from around the country. What stands out to you?
What jumps out, Robin, is that there is some good news that we have a declining number of cases around the country as a whole, which illustrates that the interventions that we put into place, these interventions like mask mandates, like restricting these, in particular, these very high-risk settings like indoor bars, that they are making a difference. And now we have schools open, we have university students coming back, and I do fear that we will be trending in the wrong direction soon, that we are having these rolling waves around the country. And I think people need to keep in mind, especially as we come into Labor Day, that we cannot do it all, that we can't do all of our normal pre-pandemic normal activities. So if we want schools to remain open, we need to be doing our best in limiting our interactions in these high-risk settings. And of course, to stay outdoors, wear masks, and practice social distancing.
Well, and when you say stay outdoors, we're going into cold season in many parts of the country. People won't be able to do that. And you mentioned colleges. 36 states are confirming a total of 8,700 cases at colleges and universities. This is just after a few weeks of coming back. Now, some would say, oh, that's just because of more testing. But isn't that because of these, as you say, waves that we're seeing as young people in college settings are near each other?
Right. And I would argue that we almost certainly have many times more the number of cases than are the ones that are detected because we don't have enough testing and we need far more of that and not less. And when we have people coming from all over the country to colleges, they are going to bring the virus with them. And even if colleges have implemented, as many have, very good mitigation measures on their campuses, it's much harder to control what it is that students do off campus. And we are going to see in a spike, an increased spike of cases in the weeks to come.
Well, and you mentioned the good news, though, that overall numbers are going down, although there are plateaus, meaning they're kind of stuck. And there are hotspots, Michigan, Utah, Minnesota. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think this is the trend that we are beginning to see and are going to continue to see as time goes on. That initially, as you know, back in March, April, we had the epicenter in one area of the country, in the New York region. But then many others started in the Sun Belt and the South and California. Now we have this wave that we're seeing in the Midwest. And the key is to have the policies in place so that we're able to detect these outbreaks before they become full-blown epidemics.
Yeah. And what do you make of this new claim? It was tweeted out by Gateway Pundit, a conservative website. The president retweeted it. It's been making its way through other sources as well, that there are really only 9,000 American deaths because of COVID-19. And in the tweets from Gateway Pundit, they diss Drs. Fauci and Birx, who are supposed to be the nation's number one voices on this, and the president retweets this. Let's just say it is categorically false that there have only been 9,000 deaths.
It's completely wrong, and it is a total misinterpretation of the truth of the data. What the CDC's data are saying is that 6% of COVID-19 deaths list only COVID-19. Others list comorbidities, for example, heart disease, lung disease, and list circumstances of deaths, for example, cardiac arrest or respiratory failure. That does not mean that only 6% of deaths are due to COVID-19. It means that these other death certificates and coding, the way that they're listed, also list these other factors that contribute to death and that list circumstances around their deaths as well. And so I think if anything, we know that the number of deaths we have that are attributed to COVID-19, that they are an undercount. Because when we look at another factor, which is excess deaths, the number of deaths this year compared to the same time last year, we know that there were 215,000 more U.S. deaths from March to July 2020 than at baseline. 71% of those were diagnosed as due to COVID-19. And so we know that the number of deaths actually attributed to COVID-19 is higher than the number that's reported by the CDC due to specifically just COVID-19. We should not be underestimating the true toll of this extremely contagious and deadly disease.
Or falsifying it. Dr. Lena Wen, emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University, thank you.
Thank you.
This Wednesday marks 75 years since the Japanese surrender ceremony ended the Second World War. And some people are rediscovering World War II artifacts, including inscribed Japanese flags taken as souvenirs by American soldiers from Pacific battlefields. Now, aging veterans and their descendants here in the U.S. are attempting to return the memorabilia to families of their former enemies ahead of the anniversary. Tom Bonzi from the Northwest News Network has our story.
Rex and Keiko Zeke co-founded a humanitarian nonprofit in Astoria, Oregon, called the Obon Society. It repatriates Japanese World War II flags and relics. Rex Zeke says he and his wife noticed something after the pandemic hit and the U.S. went into lockdown.
We think people being stuck at home did a deeper spring cleaning than normal. They had time to open up the closets and the attics and dig through boxes they hadn't seen for many years.
Among the items rediscovered were war souvenirs that aging veterans or their children now want to give back. Keiko Zeke says many American GIs who fought in the Pacific during World War II brought home Japanese flags with calligraphy on them.
Many Americans call this flag good luck flag, but we, as a Japanese, we call it Yosegaki Hinomaru.
The direct translation is group-written flag, bearing messages from friends, and containing clues to locate the original owner's family home. The Zeke say their nonprofit has had an uptick in submissions of war souvenirs to return to Japan, mostly small flags, along with a rifle and bayonet, several swords, a helmet, diaries, and photo albums.
Although they can't read Japanese, they feel something important.
This springtime and even this throughout the summer and even now, people were not only tidying up their houses, they were tidying up our past history.
Greg Murphy of Portland, Oregon knows this sentiment. He inherited a blood-stained Japanese flag when his father passed away. Murphy's father, James, fought with the U.S. Army during World War II.
He was stationed in the Philippines, and I believe that's where he got the flag. He didn't talk much about it.
Before the pandemic, Murphy showed the World War II flag to some friends, a couple who are Japanese-American. They explained to him its significance.
I realized then what that flag must have meant for somebody. It would be like somebody here losing someone and getting their dog tags back.
Murphy offered the flag to the Obon Society, and with help from research partners in Japan, they were able to trace down the name of the Japanese soldier who carried that flag into battle for the last time on New Year's Eve in 1944. They returned it to a living nephew who got the flag back at a ceremony in Japan last year. Greg Murphy received pictures and a thank you note.
And I was just overwhelmed. I mean, after all these years, they finally get something back, something that I don't know if I could say we owe the Japanese people. I know they bombed us, but I think it's just a closure, And it's a big thing to get the end of that era over with.
The Obon Society's Rex Zeke says the new frontier for the nonprofit comes from all kinds of museums getting in touch.
So we are being contacted more frequently now by museums asking us to review their collections and identify the personal family items so that they can return those to the families in Japan.
The Obon Society returned its first flag to Japan in 2013. Last year, it processed 120 flags. Zeke says they aspire to scale up donations to handle around 360 war items per year, or about one family heirloom going back to Japan every day. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
Tomorrow is the first of the month, which means rent is due for many Americans, but many of them will come up short. The economic devastation of the coronavirus pandemic has put as many as 40 million people at risk of eviction by the end of the year. That's according to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. A federal ban on evictions from public housing ended in July, and many state and local protections for renters with or without federal housing assistance are expiring soon. We're going to hear from three people struggling to pay rent, starting with Jackie Sayer from Marion, Ohio, a place with no special protections against eviction. She was laid off from her job at a hotel after the pandemic hit and went on unemployment in March.
And so now my unemployment amount is $219 a week. There for a while, we were getting the extra $600, which was keeping everything alive, but $200 a week is not going to pay my rent, which is $675 a month, my car payment, my insurance, and my electric. 1 month I try to pay my rent, 1 month I try to make my car payment. And so I'm just juggling from month to month. It's just very stressful not knowing what's going to happen.
Sayer says she's trying to work something out with her landlord, who has already evicted some of her neighbors. But she says it's hard to see how she'll get by unless lawmakers pass some sort of rent relief.
I just wish as long as this COVID is going on, I wish that there was some way they could give us at least some kind of assistance for rent, not even cash. I don't even care if they would pay my landlord directly and not even put the money in my hand, but just help us with some kind of rent relief or mortgage payments that people have been impacted.
In California, a moratorium on courts processing evictions expires tomorrow. And with further protections tied up in the state legislature, it's unclear what tenant protections are still in place. Ann O'Shea is a 33-year-old marketing freelancer in Los Angeles, and she's been struggling to keep up with all of the changes.
There are different laws at the city, county, state, and federal level. You know, because there are all these different dates floating around and things are changing, like it can become a full-time job to kind of sort through what the law is today.
Inspired by the growing tenants' rights movement calling for the cancellation of rent, O'Shea and her neighbors formed a tenants' association.
We set up a meeting in our backyard where we just came together and talked about what is happening right now. You know, like we're all able to share how we were individually being affected. What's the full range of challenges that we're experiencing? And that included, like, do people have enough food? And then from there, talking about, like, okay, who can pay rent? Like, who can pay rent this month? And then who feels confident they could pay rent next month? And that's where things really started to shift. So many of us were on the brink before. And so the pandemic really pushed things over the edge and just, like, created this new layer of uncertainty.
O'Shea owes more than $1,000 in rent. And she says through all of this, her neighbors have become a source of comfort and strength.
When I get a letter from my landlord, or, you know, really at a certain point, any communication with my landlord, just because of that power dynamic, like this is the person who, if we're talking about one-on-one, this is the person who has the power to decide if I have a home or not. That's really scary. My initial instinct is to feel fear. And that changes as soon as I talk to one of my neighbors.
In Kenner, Louisiana, where evictions resumed in June, Christian Cowens, a mother of seven, left her home of 18 years before her landlord officially filed for an eviction.
I knew I didn't have the money to pay, so I didn't want to have to go through courts, or I just decided to pick up and just go. I actually was homeless for, I want to say, probably a week or two. And of course, I didn't have my kids at the time, but I was pretty much living on the streets. I've never been in that predicament before, but I made the best of it. And actually, when unemployment kicked in, that's when I went to WoodSpring Suites and I got us a hotel room there. So we were still struggling there too, you know, as far as food and stuff like that. So unemployment just paid for our room at that point.
Cowens is a self-employed house cleaner who lost all of her clients because of the pandemic. She says her unemployment benefits come out to $107 per week. Thanks to some temporary rental assistance, she found a new home in a trailer. But she says unless she finds a job soon, she could be facing eviction again.
I'm stressing because I'm struggling. I'm trying to find a job. I'm putting in, you know, applications. We're hoping, you know, I'm able to get a job and be able to pay the rent for next month. Because, again, I was told by the landlady, you know, by the 19th of next month, if I don't have the rent money, I gotta go.
In spite of everything, Cowens remains hopeful. She says she even checks in on people she knows who are struggling, including her former landlady, whose property she was forced to leave. Cowens calls her a friend and knows she is also suffering during this pandemic.
No matter how big COVID wants to be, it's not going to come and tear friendship and family apart with me. You know, and even though I'm in the boat I'm in, I'm still looking to help other people because there's a lot of people that need help.
Eviction bans are set to expire in 8 more states by the end of September.
We're going to have an update on the employment picture later this week. The experts see some hopeful signs. Economists are expecting another 1.4 million jobs added in August, bringing the total of recovered jobs to 10.8 million. But that's only about half of what was lost in March and April. And millions of Americans are still suffering as a second round of stimulus remains elusive. And now a tidal wave of evictions could be coming as we pass September 1 tomorrow. So let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money, and all-around therapist. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Well, you always help us at these times when we think things are out of control and we have to do something drastic. You have a list, you know, of things that give us some control over our financial lives. What's at the top?
Well, number one is always to go back to basics. And I go pull the clock back to, let's say, late February, early March, and I would give this kind of advice out all the time, and people would be sort of, yeah, me. But when the bad times really did hit and people got scared, I cannot tell you how many folks would email me and say, oh, I heard you with Robin on Here and Now. What should I do? What should I do? And really what you should do is go back to basics. Start with your cash flow. Figure out what's coming in the door, what's going out. And I think that 6 months after that time, what I want to amend it and say is that it is more important than ever to become digital with your financial life, electronic bill paying, tax filing, and record keeping as well.
And why is that?
Because I think that what we found is that people moving around so much, and with the postal service being a little bit hinky right now, having electronic billing is so much easier. And of course, those who filed electronically for their taxes, they got their refunds faster. They also got those economic stimulus checks much faster.
Yeah. Okay. What about people facing evictions tomorrow, the 1st?
You know, I think it's really important to stay out in front of your landlord. And sometimes people get really intimidated. You know, there is a dynamic that exists that's kind of scary, like, oh, that landlord has all the power. But you're there. You're in the apartment. You let the landlord know, hey, I lost my job, or I was rehired and now let go again. Negotiate. There are so many folks out there who are willing to keep you in that apartment, but you've got to raise your hand. You've got to ask for that help, and you've got to put those folks on notice.
negotiate with everybody. You say large institutions, you know, even small-time landlords, they're people too, and they need to have the income. But, you know, you can negotiate with just about everybody. But what if you are a business and you're facing eviction?
You know, if you're a business particularly, it's almost back to basics on steroids because, you know, many businesses came into this period, like some individuals, feeling a little bit tight, operating on very thin margins. I think especially for a business, a retailer, a restaurant, you're going to find that your landlords and the folks who maybe hold mortgages with larger companies, they have some flexibility with their folks. They're going to give you some flexibility and stand firm. On the other hand, I also want to remind everyone that there are times where a business must fail, and it's a terrible situation. I was a small business owner. I've walked through these times with you. I understand it. But there is sometimes a business that must fail, and you should not drag your entire family's financial future down with that business.
I'm going to close with the thing that you always say. Do not be tempted to touch your retirement fund, your stocks, if you don't have to. Just sit quiet. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
So my sister sent me these YouTube videos she'd fallen for. His name is Teddy Swims, she said. He's like the new Michael McDonald. Well, I thought, I'll be the judge of that. And then, wait a minute, 24 million views on one video? Covers of Mario, Billie Eilish, Bonnie Raitt. He's not going there, is he? Oh, he is. 'Cause I can't make you love me if you don't. Something it won't hear in the dark. And what's been the reaction? Well, those young people who do reaction videos to songs are thrilled the first time they hear Teddy. Here's NJ Cheese listening to Teddy's cover of Billie Eilish's I Don't Want to Be You Anymore. She'll
never tell. Oh my God. What? Yo, this man is so soulful. Like, the way he's dragging his words out and the sentences and, oh, man. The effects on his voice is not too much, but just enough.
Singer Teddy Swims became a YouTube sensation with his covers, and he's just released a new original single, Broke. I'm so used to being broke. Well, we wanted to know more about this white, full-bearded, free-spirited grandson of a Pentecostal preacher who also played football, sang in musical theater, and changed his name to Swims because it means someone who isn't me. And Teddy Swims joins us now by Skype. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
No, pleasure's ours. Swims is not your real name. You were born Jayton Dimsdale and grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Did you sing in church?
I didn't really start singing and like taking it seriously until I got into theater. That's kind of like halfway through high school. I kind of found musical theater. My buddy Jesse, who plays guitar and is my best friend still, his dad and his family were like the first people I ever saw in front of me that like played acoustic and sang. And that kind of got me into theater, and I fell in love with theater, and it changed my entire life.
Can you just give us a taste of the 10th grader who fell in love with musical theater?
If you like Rent, I'm absolutely, I love Rent. Like Rent is the
best.
Go. One song, glory, one song before I go. Glory, one song to leave behind. Find one song, one last refrain. That song for me is like always been, Roger was really a life-changing role for me. I love, absolutely love that show.
But then here you are, this, you know, now this YouTube star, you're singing songs like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, which you did donating all proceeds to Black organizations. This was during the beginning of the Black Lives Matter racial reckoning. I just want to listen to a little bit of this.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know that we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh, Father, Father, Father.
So Teddy Swims, people were a little worried. This white guy from Atlanta taking on this just epic song, and the comments are, you killed it, and thank you for bringing this song to a new generation.
I'm so lucky to have been raised in a place where I was exposed to a lot of different things in my life and a lot of different types of music in my life. And that for me was the biggest thing that we wanted to do with our covers, was try to expose people. You know, there may be, I say it all the time, there may be the 50-year-old Southern man here in Georgia, right, that have never heard a song by somebody like her, Summer Walker, some amazing, singers. And so for us, we wanted to be able to provide that so somebody could say, wow, man, I actually like this song, or I actually like this Shania Twain song, or I like, just to bridge those gaps.
You mentioned Shania Twain. This is your cover of You're Still the One. Let's listen. One of the most cornball, wonderful songs of all time, which you dedicate your cover to your mom.
Yeah, she played stuff like that growing up. That's my best friend in the whole wide world right there. I'm very, very, very fortunate to have parents, that care about me pursuing a dream. Mm. If I could find a woman that's half the woman my mama is, then she's the one.
Oh, boy. We liked you before Teddy Swims, and now look what you do. Hey, but you mentioned your mom and your dad. If I've got this right, Grandpa was a Pentecostal preacher.
Absolutely, yeah.
Conservative. What is the sense in the family of what Teddy or Jayton is doing?
They're very, very proud. I can definitely say that as I've grown, I wouldn't get into my spiritual belief now where I'm at spiritually with God or anything like that. But what I can say is at the very core of everything, that because of my granddad, he's put a covering over our entire family of work ethic, of morality, of just how to be a person and how to be who you stand for. He's never been a hypocrite. That man, when he was alive, was the real, real deal.
Well, I was thinking, in a way, you, the grandson, have a little bit of the preacher in you. I'm looking at what you wrote for your posting of the Marvin Gaye, What's Going On? And you write, love all who have love for all. Use your voice. Protest on social media. Protest on the streets. Donate. Donate if you can. I love you. You have a bit of a flock.
Oh, absolutely. And then that's something that has been told to me my whole life. It's like, you have this huge calling in your life, this huge thing over you. So for my whole life, this is all I wanted, was to be somebody with something to say. I feel like so many people are doing music and they have a platform. We all have an opportunity to have a platform to say something these days because of social media, but it's just nobody says anything. And so for me, I just feel like we're trying to do something so much bigger than us. And it's not about me. It's never gonna be about me.
Let's listen to a little of your cover of Mario's Let Me Love You.
You should let me love. Let me be the one to give you everything you want and need. Baby, good love and protection. Make me your selection. Show you the way love's supposed to be. Baby, you should let me love.
Teddy Swims, some other comments with this YouTube video. listening to this made me pregnant and I'm a man. Here's another one. Teddy's channel is where grown men come to cry when no one is watching.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad to hear that, because that's what I wanted to be. That's the place I go to cry. So, you know, it makes me feel good that people feel that same way. I want it to be a safe space. I do. I want it to be a place that, you know, we can all come together and it just be positivity and love. I definitely want it to be a safe space. It's the only place in my life I feel like I'm truly got myself organized and truly living in the moment.
Yeah. Teddy Swims, just such a pleasure talking to you. My sister was right. And just really, really appreciate it. And best of luck to you.
Hey, thank you so much. I'll be sweet. Airbnb up in the hills, it costs as much as little brother's college bills.
Again, this is Teddy's brand new original single, Broke. The EP is down the road, and we'll have links to some of his great covers at hearnow.org. I also recommend you find the Reactors on YouTube. People reacting to songs like Teddy's, just great.
We're checking in on Senate races across the country in our Here and Now Senate Tracker series. And today we go to Oklahoma, where Republican incumbent Senator Jim Inhofe faces a challenger, Democrat Abby Broyles. Caitlin Howard is with KGOU Public Radio. She's in Norman, Oklahoma. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get right to the candidates, starting with Abby Broyles, a lawyer and former television reporter. Here is a video she posted on Twitter this month about the debate over systemic racism in the United States.
Absolutely, we have a problem with systemic racism. Look at the disparities in our criminal justice system, in healthcare. Look at the disparities in education and housing. We are finally having important, meaningful conversations. We need leaders who are going to call out injustice when we see it so that everyone can have equality under the law.
Caitlin, what can you tell us about Abby Broyles and what she's running on?
As you said, Broyles is a former TV journalist at a news station in Oklahoma City. She's 30 years old and up to this point has no political experience. And if she was to win, she'd be the first woman to serve in the U.S. Senate from Oklahoma. She has a platform related to issues such as having access to affordable health care, closing the gender pay gap, criminal justice reform. But her main campaign strategy has been to criticize Inhofe and his political record at her events. She has challenged Inhofe to debates multiple times, but he has not agreed so far to participate in any of them.
And Senator Inhofe has been in the Senate for more than 20 years. He's the chair of the Armed Services Committee. Here he is in a June interview on Fox News talking about President Trump and the pandemic.
What would happen if this virus came when we started with an average economy? He gave us the best economy I've had in my lifetime. And fortunately, that for us, that's when all this started. So I think we're going to survive this thing. When this is over, we'll look back and say, we're sure glad we had a president who was really who had the country in good shape. And
what has Senator Inhofe's record been like in recent years, and what is he campaigning on?
So, as you had said, he was first elected to the Senate in 1994, and before that, he was a U.S. representative and the mayor of Tulsa. And he has pretty much maintained campaigning on a lot of the same issues over during his time in the Senate, which has been things related to defense and the military, energy and the environment and infrastructure. And he also this year has really leaned on talking about how he's a close ally to President Trump. But his two biggest issues are defense and the military and energy and the environment. Since Oklahoma has a lot of military installations, he's worked to try to secure more funding for the military. He also used to be the chair of the U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. So Inhofe is known for frequently being at odds with the Environmental Protection Agency over regulations and has referred to global warming in the past as a hoax. And since the oil and gas industry is big in Oklahoma, he has supported legislation that would give states more control over fracking.
Okay. Senator Inhofe is 85 years old. He released an ad of himself flying a plane upside down, and he said he would always serve in the Senate as long as he could fly upside down. You mentioned some of the things that Abby Broyles has said about her opponent, but has age been a factor in this race?
Age has been a big factor. Abby Broyles is 30 years old, and she has spent a lot of her campaigning efforts focusing on the fact that Inhofe is 85 years old and that she thinks he's out of touch with Oklahomans and that he should not be in the Senate any longer since he has held that seat since 1994. And I think it will be interesting to see if Oklahoma voters do decide to elect someone who is younger, if they're willing to take the risk to elect someone that has little to no political experience.
There's also something else, though. In 2016, President Trump won Oklahoma by more than 30 percentage points. We heard Inhofe talking about the economy and Trump's record on that. How is he talking about the president, and how is the presidential race impacting the Senate contest?
As of right now, it doesn't seem like the presidential race will have a big impact on the outcome of the Senate race, given the inherently conservative nature of Oklahoma's electorate and the fact that Trump currently has about a 20-point lead in Oklahoma over Biden. But if there is an aspect of the presidential race that could factor in, it would probably be Inhofe's close relationship with Trump and how he often boasts about his strong allegiance to the president. This seems to resonate with Republicans in Oklahoma who view Inhofe as a politician who has opened doors for Oklahomans on a national level due to his relationship with the president. So those Republican voters in Oklahoma might feel even more inclined to vote for Inhofe based off of that.
What do polls say right now?
Right now, Inhofe currently has about a 16-point lead over Broyles. This race is also currently rated as solid Republican by the Cook Political Report, meaning it's not considered competitive at this point, and it's unlikely Inhofe will lose his Senate seat that he's had since 1994.
That's Caitlin Howard. She's a reporter with KGOU Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. We'd love your thoughts at hereandnow.org. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. The Postal Service is facing a crisis less than 10 weeks out from an election where huge numbers of people will likely vote by mail because of the pandemic. We'll look at how we got here and what the Postal Service needs now. That's next time on Here and Now.